Welcome to Holden Village. In the Inquiring Mind series of lectures, Gordon Jackson will be giving a talk entitled, The Alien Has Landed. So let's listen in on Gordon.
We have a special presentation by Dr. Gordon Jackson, who comes to us by way of Whitworth College in Spokane, Washington. Dr. Jackson is on the communications faculty there, professor of communications, and his area of expertise is communications, South African politics. Correct me whenever I'm
wrong. You're
doing fine. Okay. He's a native of South Africa and did his undergraduate studies in South Africa, completing undergraduate studies in social anthropology, sociology, and African studies, and then came over to the United States and took his PhD in mass communication at the School of Journalism at Indiana University, and is going to present a series of lectures at Holden Village this week, and the first one is called The Alien Has Landed. This program is sponsored by the Washington Commission for the Humanities and part of the Inquiring Mind series, and we always put a plug in for the Washington Commission for the Humanities and ask for your support that makes these wonderful programs possible. And if you're interested in how you might be able to more support them, there's some brochures up here on the hearth that you can look at afterwards. So please welcome Dr. Jackson.
Thank you. Before we begin, I think I have an urgent message from my daughter. And I think it concerns ice creams and the long line. That's the story. Well, it's a delight to be here. I've heard some things about Holden Village. The legend is proving to be true. I've so appreciated the warmth of the welcome we've received since we got here this afternoon. And I look forward to being with you for the next several days. To give you a little bit of a sense of what's going to be ahead, this evening I will be giving what was correctly described as a light-hearted kind of presentation. It's meant to be a personal reflection on some of the things I noticed on moving from one culture to this culture. And we'll spend a little while looking at some examples of communication and miscommunication. But the two other presentations I'll be having may interest you in a quite different way. Those are of a much more serious note, and one ties in with my interest in South Africa from the political realm. I have an ongoing interest in the political developments, especially in the media in that country, and I will be giving one talk on the prospects for South Africa developing a sense of national unity. South Africa is a country that is known for its divided nature. And the question now is, in its democratic era, as it's got beyond the apartheid era, how successful is it likely to be to develop a true sense of national unity? So that's an issue we'll explore in one of the other presentations. The third talk that I'll be doing is on media ethics. And many people would see the idea of media ethics as being an oxymoron. And that's the very issue that I want to explore, because I argue that at the same time that the American public sees the media as being perhaps more lacking in credibility than ever, at least in recent history, I would argue that at the same time the media have never been more ethical. And how do you put those two ideas together? And we'll have to look at that another time, because we've got an agenda item tonight of The Alien Has Landed. What I want to do this evening is give you a purely personal reflection. This is not meant to be an academic address at all. It's not meant to be a serious address. And the thing I want to emphasize is that it's meant to be a lighthearted journey that I'd like you to accompany me on. And I want to do three things this evening. The first is I want to describe the kind of change I encountered, or the kind of environment I encountered when I first arrived in this country. I'd learned about this concept of culture shock and came here expecting culture shock, and I want to describe what I found at that point. The second thing comes at a point after I'd been in this country for a little while, and I call that the rude awakening. And the third one is the question I would call, or the description I'd give it, is a closer look. So those would be the three things that I would want to focus on as one goes on this journey. But let's take a quite different journey for now and imagine, for example, that you are a student, an exchange student from Germany or Japan or South America, that your English is pretty good. You've got very good English skills, but you haven't lived out that English in this culture. You've learned English from books, you've had pretty good English teachers in your own culture, and you then come into this society. I want to show you what your experience could be like if you were to travel around this country reading road signs, reading other public communications, and maybe having impressions that were not intended by the people who put up those communications. And I'm going to show you now a collection of signs that I've literally spent a quarter of a century collecting. I began this hobby when I was a student myself in 1969. I was traveling in Europe and I came across a book that said very simply, "Jail keys made here and other signs." I thought, wait a minute, this sounds odd. And I looked through this book and there were signs in it that said things like, "Stereo headphones for people with two ears." This is my kind of book. And it got me alerted to the idea that signs have an especial communications problem that comes with them. They're like headline writing. You've got only so much space in which you can communicate a message clearly and effectively. And sometimes it doesn't come across as well as you'd like. So imagine, if you will, that you're this exchange student on this journey traveling around the United States. All of the signs that you're about to see are from Canada and from the United States. I have several rules in taking these photographs. One of them is I do not tell you what the context of the sign is. I won't tell you where I got them. The other rule is that I do not in any way tamper with the signs. What you see is what you got, what I got. If it's a reader board with some strange message on it, I didn't play around with it. That's what was there for everyone to read. So let's have a look at see what you come up with.
Light the lights out?
Yes, please. This is the very famous test slide. Now this one is terribly troubling to me because as someone who teaches journalism and is concerned with language, I look at this and I say, are we talking here about one nanus? What is the plural of this? Would this be two nanis? What is a nanus in the first place? And someone's put this here, gone to the effort of putting it there for a good reason. Is it because I'm supposed to look over here and see this wonderful sight? Am I missing something when I look up and I don't see a darn thing? Or is it a warning and I'm looking up and I don't see anything and I have no idea why I'm supposed to be scared, but I know I am. And the sign leaves me completely bewildered and sort of thing, yeah, I lose sleep over it. Myself, went home to get the camera, and by the time I got back, the sign had been removed, and it was simply student barbecue. Same thing. From worms.
Oh,
so the absence of
the preposition here is very important or very disturbing to the person who doesn't know whether it's for, of, by, or whatever.
After encountering messages like that. Fortunately, my situation when I first came to the country was very different. I had the benefit of growing up in a Western-oriented society. South Africa is a very mixed country, as you well know, but as an English-speaking South African, I grew up in a Western environment. I grew up in what was a capitalist economic system. So as someone who could already speak English fluently, about to come to this country, I was quite interested when I got information for me as an international student saying things like, when you go along to the local store, don't haggle over prices. Many people who are coming from abroad as students are in
economies that are very different, and you would do that kind of haggling. And I felt a little patronized when I got that sort of instruction telling me, you don't go to Albertsons and haggle over the price of lettuce. And I know that, I'm a sophisticated person. I'd read a lot about America, I'd subscribed to Time and Newsweek, and I was pretty familiar with many aspects of the society, but I was still expecting there to be some culture shock when I arrived. And I came waiting for it to hit. And the biggest surprise I had was that there was no surprise. That there was nothing that really hit me over the head. Oh, to be sure, there were differences. The light switches, for example, are the wrong way around here. And I figured it had to do something with being in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, or gravity or whatever. I don't know how electricity works, but that's one difference. Another difference, of course, is that everybody had an accent, and I noticed it immediately. Another difference is that the people all drove on the wrong side of the road. But these were superficial things, and these weren't the kinds of things that you say, wow, these are deep, profound differences. And as I looked at them, I said, well, where's this culture shock that everybody's talking about? And nothing came. And I found myself most surprised by the fact that there was no surprise. Until one particular day when I was a student in the graduate lounge in Wheaton College, which some of you may be aware of. Wheaton, Illinois, is a fairly conservative school. Its most famous alum is Billy Graham. And I had a wonderful year and a half there in the graduate program doing communications. And understand the setting. It's the graduate lounge, and I'm on my own there with a student named Arlene, whom I knew fairly well, and we were sitting there, and I was working on some project, and I realized that I didn't bring with me something from home that I was needing for the project, and I stood up and went to her, obviously with some urgency to get this thing done. I said to her, Arlene, do you have a rubber? And the look on her face reminded me instantly of what all good South African boys are told before they leave the shores about the distinction between an eraser and a rubber, and that you are not to confuse these two. And the look on her face left me absolutely nonplussed, and I didn't know how to recover from this. We weren't given that in our cultural awareness in South Africa. And I sort of looked at her and I stammered some, I'll get one somewhere else. And I left. And to this day, I have no idea what she thought of me. But that little incident helped me wake up to the reality that I wasn't as familiar with this culture and I wasn't as much at home in this culture as I thought. And I then began to look around for other rude awakenings. And another one that came when I was in grad school at Wheaton was from a professor who invited me to come round to have a meal sometime. And he said this to a number of us in the class, it would be nice to get together. And I took him literally. I assumed that if he said, come around for food, I will come around for food. And when I took him up on it, I sensed a certain awkwardness, but well, maybe it's just timing or whatever. But it began to help me understand a little bit better the difference between a literal invitation or a casual comment. And even now, I struggle with what is the actual intent behind certain statements, because Americans use language in a very different way at times from what many people outside the country are used to. And I'll give some other examples later. When my wife, who is also South African, and I came to Spokane, we had a couple of other experiences of cultural differences. One came a few months after we'd arrived. We'd settled at a Presbyterian church, and the pastor there was a wonderful gardener, a very successful gardener. And one day he brought around to our house this splendid example of a pumpkin from his own garden. And he gave it to us, and we were so grateful because we just hadn't seen anything like that before. Well, a few weeks later, after Halloween had come and gone, he said to us, well, how did you like the pumpkin? We said, it was wonderful, we ate it. Which is what you do with pumpkin, it's a great vegetable. And we, unsteeped in the barbaric ways of Americans, wanted to take a beautiful vegetable and hack it into shapes to terrify young children on a pagan holiday at the end of October. We were sort of left out of the loop on this, and had no idea that that's what we were supposed to do with this prize vegetable he'd given us. And he was quite disappointed. When we were in graduate school in Indiana, we were invited by some American friends to come along and make some homemade ice cream with them. Sounded like a great idea. And even though we were all impoverished students at the time, we said, well, what can we bring? And he said, well, bring along some rock salt. Okay, sure, we'll bring along some rock salt. We had never made ice cream with rock salt before. We didn't quite know why you needed that particular kind of salt. Obviously, you needed it for the flavoring, but why rock salt? Well, we went along to the store, and that's what he told us. And the only rock salt we could find were these enormous bags of the stuff. And it's ice cream for only four of us, for goodness sakes. You don't need a huge bag like that. Why are we going to buy that much and waste all of it? And you obviously know what the punchline is, but suffer through the story with me. And we said, we are not going to waste our tight student budget money on this kind of huge bag. And I'm ashamed to admit that we found a bag that had been ripped open. There were some crystals that were lying around there. And we figured all we need for flavoring for four people is just a handful of crystals. This bag is already destroyed. They can't use it. This doesn't exactly constitute theft. The people will understand. So we took these few crystals along, and that was our contribution to the ice cream. And when we got there, our friend had fortunately served as a missionary kid in Uganda, and he knew about the ways of culturally ignorant people. He shrugged and said, let's head off to the store. And we learned about making ice cream in a whole new way that evening. They were very understanding about it. So that was one of the blunders that we encountered. We have a friend at the college who's from the Middle East, and he and his wife on one occasion were visiting people in Colorado, not having been in the country very long, and they were invited to these people's home, and the Americans said to them, well, we're going to be having something to eat now. Would you care to join us? And being very polite Middle Easterners, they said, oh, no, thank you. Because they knew that a gracious host would say to them, no, please, do have something to eat. And they would say, oh, no, really, we won't. And the gracious host would, of course, say, come on, just have something. And they'd say, well, all right, maybe a little bit. But, of course, being Americans, they said, well, that's fine. If you don't mind, we're just going to go ahead. And these poor people sat there starving as their hosts went ahead eating, and they went without. And that, they said, was a mistake that they made only once. And so that brings you to the point of realizing there are things that are different and that there are gaps that are out there. And it brings us then, as people from outside this culture, to the point of saying, well, we need to take a closer look at what's going on here. And as someone who teaches journalism and is concerned particularly with words, I'm mostly interested in how people use language differently. And I find some very fascinating tendencies in American English. And what I find equally interesting when I go back to South Africa is to see how English speakers in that country have adopted a growing number of Americanisms and American traits. Some of them neutral enough, some bad, some good. But there's some very interesting differences. One of them, for example, would be a simple matter of usage. And imagine, if you will, a South African marrying an American, and this conversation taking place just after dinner. The husband says, the wife says, could you please take out the trash? We'll go with traditional gender role models, yeah? And the husband says, being a South African, sure, I'll do it just now. Which to the South African means, I'll get around to it sometime in the foreseeable future. And the wife understands just now, like most Americans, to mean immediately, right now. And you've got that gap in understanding of a very simple everyday phrase. Another example that comes to my mind is with the word fetch. And fetch in this country, or I discovered this in Indiana, has negative connotations. Because I'd say something like, I need to go now. I've got to go and fetch Sue from grad school. Fetch your wife? You only fetch dogs, or dogs fetch them. So people don't fetch. And there were these peculiar looks. And then the looks would soften as if to say, he's obviously ignorant. He doesn't understand these things. But that's the kind of thing you have to pick up by watching people's expressions. You realize that you're doing something wrong. Another example came up when my parents-in-law were visiting us at Indiana, and my father-in-law had a lot of digestive problems, was taking something that he brought over in a bottle, which unfortunately got smashed in his luggage, and we had to go and replace it. And we thought, where are we going to find liquid paraffin? Nobody here will know what liquid paraffin is. I thought, how do we find out what this is? We phoned a pharmacist who didn't know what we were talking about. Then it clicked. The doctor we went to at the medical center there had spent quite a bit of time in Australia. And we figured, maybe he'll know. And we phoned him, and he said, ah, yes, you're talking about mineral oil. And that's what we wanted. We could have gone into a pharmacist and tried to explain it, and wouldn't have got very far. And a very simple concept, but something which just using very different phrasing. Questions of idiom, questions of actual word usage. One of the things that I find interesting is the Americans' preoccupation with prepositions. And I see this spreading to South Africa and elsewhere. But think, for example, of the phrases that are common in American usage and look at the redundancy that's built into them. For example, people in this country don't head committees, they head up committees. Or you don't get off something, you get off of your cloud. Okay? You don't, something isn't outside your department, it's outside of your department. It would be common usage to hear that. And I could say that the list continues on. Can anyone tell me why Americans have tuna fish but they don't have beef meat? Why is a tuna, out of all the fish, that has that suffix of tuna fish? And you always hear about it being a tuna fish casserole or whatever. We have some South African friends who now live near Seattle. And after they'd been here for a while and got pretty acculturated, and were very good friends with a particular American family, they were going to go and visit them on one occasion and knew the kinds of pitfalls to avoid in language. And just as they were about to leave, a crisis occurred that obviously led to a communications blunder. Their car broke down. And so my South African friend phoned the American and said, could you please come and get us? We're all ready to leave, but the car's packed up. And the car is packed up. There's a South African expression meaning the car's dead, it's finished, lifeless. And so he heard, our car is all packed, come and get us. And so they had to talk to and through each other for a few minutes before they actually figured out what was going on. And the fascinating thing is you're talking here about people like myself, like my South African friends, who've grown up speaking what is essentially the same language. And here there are these communication gaps. But you find the same thing in this country. I don't know if any of you are from the South or from other regions in the country where there are significant usage differences. And I know if you had a very cosmopolitan group of Americans here, you could hold up a bottle of Coke and say, what did you call this stuff when you were growing up? Because different parts of the country would refer to it as soda. Some people might just call it Coke, or you might call it pop. In South Africa, we call it cool drinks when we were growing up. And so even in the same country, you will have these noticeable regional differences. A friend in grad school told me about someone he knew who was from the northeast, went down south, and went into a store, bought some stuff. And as he was leaving, the clerk said to him, come back. Which, of course, the fella did. He turned around, walked to the counter, and said, yes. And the woman looked up at him and said, yes. And it took a while for them to realize that they just weren't communicating. But there's several other things that one can focus on as one comes into a different country. You look at the language and say, yes, that's interesting. But then you begin to look at other significant things that are part of the culture. And I want to just touch on a few of them this evening. One of them is in the way people use words. So when somebody says, how are you doing? It took me a long while for me to realize this was not intended as a question. You know, I'm a reasonably educated person, so I knew I wasn't supposed to give them a full medical history, and that I was just to give them a very brief response and to say, oh, I'm doing fine. Even that would be okay. I knew it was intended as a greeting, but I was looking at it as something that demanded an actual answer.
Now, when I'm going across campus and someone says, hi, how are you doing? I just know if I, in some way, acknowledge their existence as another human being, that will suffice. That's all that that communication was expecting in return. And it amazed me how long it took me. It took me several years to realize that that question was, in fact, not a question. And so those kinds of more subtle things in the culture are harder to pick up. Another example would come in a completely different realm, and that would be when you're looking at the way people do business. It fascinates me as someone who goes back to South Africa fairly often to see the wildly differing standards in stores for consumer expectations. So we go to a store like Albertsons or Safeway where we do our supermarket shopping, and if we buy something, we get it home, we find it's bad or the bag is broken in the bread, we know we can take it back to the store. They're not even going to question us for a moment or give us a new one or we'll get our money back. They are incredibly sensitive to what I think are reasonable consumer complaints that I may take to them. South Africa is light years behind on that kind of thinking. And one example comes from a time we were spending a vacation with family members near Cape Town, and my sister-in-law went off to the store and bought some bread rolls. She brought them back, and we sat out to have them for lunch, and as we did so, we realized that they were pretty stale. And in my mind, this simply wasn't good enough, so we packed them up, and we had the ice creams. So we packed up these bread rolls, and I took them back to the bakery where we'd got them, and I said to the person, excuse me, these were bought here this morning and they're not fresh, I'd like to exchange them. And the look of astonishment that I received was quite shattering to me, because the person was saying, you mean you're not happy with stale rolls? You're daring to come here and return them. Sure, we got extras in return, but they were just so astonished that anyone would do something like that. People are meant to be happy with stale rolls or inferior products or whatever the problem might be. I'm hoping that things are slowly changing now, but I grew up in a society where if you got a lousy deal in a store, that was your bad luck. That was tough. And it's a very big difference culturally to operate in this society. Another big difference, which I don't need to tell you about, is the litigiousness that exists in this society. And how I hadn't been in the teaching game at Whitworth for very long before you realized you had to be thinking legal possibilities all the time. And you're thinking of questions of students' privacy, and how you've got to be very careful not to put out students' work so that you could come and get your assignment at the same time see her grade. And you've got to be very careful about these things. And the idea of having a parent phone me and say, how's my son doing in school? Say, I'm sorry, sir, in terms of the FERPA legislation, I'm not allowed to tell you that, even though you're paying Whitworth $18,000 a year. That kind of concept is just mind-blowing to someone like me who was used to going along to the University of Cape Town at the end of the year and seeing your grades posted on a notice board along with everybody else's. You see the people who got first class, second class, third class, and all the people who failed listed down there for the whole world to read. Very differing expectations of legal obligations, of questions of privacy, and so on. Another example that comes to mind of cultural differences that you just may not think of would be in the realm of weddings. My wife and I were married in July, and a month later, after our traditional South African wedding, we were in the States, and we'd been asked to take part in an American wedding, which we gladly did. And we were fascinated to see some significant differences, and one that still continues to amaze and amuse us, I will tell you about. But I'll tell you about it only after I've said, look at the logic of the way the South Africans do it, and the logic of the way the Americans do it, and each of them makes perfect sense. What we were fascinated by was, after our wedding, to see this American wedding occur with a trail of bridesmaids, one after the other, coming in, and finally the bride herself arrives. And we thought, this is so weird, because the way we did it was, after the groom and the rest of the party are established, you have the music coming up, and there the bride herself comes in, followed by these mere peons, the bridesmaids. Okay? And the logic of that is the most important person in that procession is the bride. And she leads the way. But look at the logic of the American way of doing it. The most important person in that procession is the bride, and so you build up to that climax with the bride at the end of the procession. And each of them is logical within its own way, but it took us quite by surprise, and we found it very amusing at the time. Another difference that I find very interesting is the way in which hospitals in this country operate and the way media, the way medical care is delivered in this country. I remember once going to a focus group meeting in Spokane. They'd phoned people who had been in the area a while, and they wanted to do some research on a particular hospital and how it should market itself. And I remember being fascinated by the fact that you've got enough medical facilities in Spokane that they have to compete with each other, and they have to know how to position themselves in a marketplace, where I was coming from a society where a huge number of people were suffering from malnutrition each day, each week, each year, and there was such a lack of basic care that in many respects you took whatever care you could get. And I think of the whole healthcare debate in this country, where Americans are very insistent on their right to choose their doctor. And the huge majority of people around the world would be grateful to have any doctor, let alone the right to insist on having this one or that one. And it's a very different set of standards that one discovers when you come from a country that does have a very strong third world component to it. There's some other differences that we have noticed. For example, tastes in food. We found it fascinating that Americans have a real hang-up about sweet breakfasts. They seem to love things like pancakes with syrup and all these sweet rolls and so on. And that was something we've adjusted to, I admit, very gladly. But it's been an interesting switch for us. Another thing that would be different that I find a very strange American phenomenon that I fear is now creeping into South Africa is this horrible, perverse tendency of mixing peanut butter and chocolate. And the idea of mixing things like that is somehow an abomination to my South African taste buds. But those are the kinds of things you adjust to and you get used to. But I do remember, on a more serious note, one of the most startling things that I encountered when I came here in 1974 was the degree of openness and the degree of self-criticism that was permitted in the society. And I came from a society which in 1974 saw apartheid at its heyday. And later on in the week I'll talk a little bit about some of the changes in South African society and how it has moved from being a very totalitarian society where information was terribly strictly controlled to a society that is now considerably more open. But America was like a breath of intellectual fresh air for me. I could get whatever books I wanted. In South Africa, certain books were simply off limits altogether. Other books were available under lock and key in the library, and you'd have to go and make a persuasive argument to a librarian why you wanted access to these dangerous materials. And Americans have not had that experience with censorship. And that kind of intellectual freedom that I discovered in 74 was a real eye-opener, and I saw that as one of the, I think, remarkable strengths of American society. I think one of the downsides of American society that I mentioned before I conclude is that Americans can be very parochial. And Americans tend to have a very narrow and limited focus of things, and I imagine we could spend time exploring some of the reasons for that. I think one of the reasons is that this is such a very big country, and it's also a country that tends to be very independent, that can be very independent of the rest of the world, or at least Americans tend to think they can be independent of the rest of the world. But there's some curious ways in which Americans tend to reflect this dominant attitude. I don't know of any other country in the world that would hold a baseball series and call it the World Series, where essentially only the Americans take part. I don't know, maybe one or two other countries that get invited, but I can't imagine South Africans having a rugby series where they play people from Zimbabwe and call it the World Series. But that to me symbolizes American thinking on a front like that. All of these kinds of exercises have forced me, have forced my wife to look at the culture that we encounter in a much more careful way. And I hope this evening that the signs that I've shown you, some of the observations I've made, will help stretch your thinking in just a way or two. One learns to cope with differences. You have, I'm sure, done some traveling, and if you've been out of the country, perhaps to a very different kind of culture, you realize you have to make quick adjustments. And if you're moving to a society where the language is completely different, where the culture is perhaps very different from what you're used to, you learn to make adjustments fast. My wife and I also have the advantage of being able to speak one of the South African languages, Afrikaans, which is a form of Dutch, and we may be behind you sometime in the supermarket to see you buying Reese's peanut butter and chocolates together, and I may sort of make snide comments about you to my wife in Afrikaans. We have the advantage of being able to cope by being in the culture but not being completely of the culture, and still being able to revert to something that helps us understand or to talk about what we're doing. We can keep some distance from the culture in which we find ourselves. One of the other things that I realize is that the accent that I have will always be with me. As long as I'm in this society, I stand out. And I'm always reminded of the fact that I'm an alien in the midst of these people whose accents don't stand out, because for you, your accent is normal. You belong here. My accent really does get noticed. And I'll conclude with an anecdote from the time I was at Wheaton. I had to do a course in astronomy to make up some deficiency, and I did some project that the professor wanted me to talk about at the end of the term, and so I went up, and as I was heading to the front of the class, he said jokingly, "Well, we're trying to get somebody from outer space and we couldn't do that, so we did the next best thing and got someone from the other side of the world." And so the students sort of laughed at me and laughed at my expense. So I paused and I said, "Is there intelligent life in the United States?" And after they settled down, I said, "Yes, but I'm only visiting." Well, this alien has decided that he likes it and he plans to stay a while. Thank you.